Okay.
We have somewhat of a quorum.
But people will come in.
Our next session, we're going to start taking what we learned in the last session, or well, at least what we talked about in the last session, and hopefully start looking through some experimental considerations that will come up, and actually how to use some of the common web tools to interact with experiments that you guys might be doing if you study real proteins. So, as we sort of have discussed, we think about proteins in lots of different ways. But one of those ways is thinking about them as chemicals. And so I am, even though I started out as a physicist, I consider myself more of a chemist now. And when you think about a protein as a chemical, all of the same things that we've talked about that you guys have hopefully talked about, or if you've had me in class, we've talked about for chemicals apply to proteins. And so if you can think of the molecular weight of sodium chloride, you can think of the molecular weight of hemoglobin. If you think of the chemical formula of methanol, proteins have a chemical formula too. And proteins are complex molecules, and so the numbers, the coefficients here, are much more complicated, but the law of definite proportions still applies to proteins, just like it does to simple alkanes that you might do elemental analysis on. as a collection of ionizable residues, proteins will have an isoelectric point, so a pH at which the net charge of the protein is neutral. Then you can also think about sequence and residue composition, solubility. Most proteins are not not terribly soluble. And so if you can make a 50 millimolar solution of phosphate buffer, or a 5 molar solution of sodium chloride, you're rarely going to be able to get concentrations of that magnitude for a protein. And that's because of its chemical properties. We've spent a lot of time talking about structure, and then from an analytical point of view, proteins will have a concentration in solution. And in my lab, we're often thinking about biophysics. And so, there we bring this idea of proteins as molecules to the forefront even more, because they're participating in chemical reactions. And so the concentration of a protein is going to be something that's very important. Just like it is when you're working and you're thinking about the decomposition of urea, and you want to know the partial pressures, the composition or the concentration of a protein is important if you're trying to work out equilibrium types of problems. And so, obviously, if you have 150 residue protein, you don't want to be in there sitting there counting carbon atoms and adding a value of 12 for every carbon atom that you count. And so there's got to be some ways that computers can help us. Maybe not access this information, but calculate. Because the calculations are all quite simple. You could do them if you have enough time and the patience. But the fact is that most of us don't have that time. Few of us have the patience. And computers really don't have they don't care. They just do what you tell them to do. Which is wonderful. So we're gonna approach this from a simple example to start. And this is a protein that, again, we've done a lot of work on in the lab. It's not intrinsically interesting. The protein is called GB3, and it participates in bacterial warfare in the sense that it's expressed on the surface of a bacterium as this sort of masking protein to make your body think that nothing is wrong, right? And so it's designed to interact with immunoglobulin domains and not to trigger or to sort of hide the bacterium from inducing an immune response. And that's kind of cool, but that's not why we study it. We study it because it's small, It's well-structured, and it behaves well when you make solutions of it. And sometimes that's what you need. But it's also nice because we can represent that protein. It's 56 amino acid protein with a nice string of reasonable amino acids. And just like in the past, 10, 15 years, search engines have made it very, very, reasonable to search large quantities of information on the internet. Basically, all of the tools that we're going to talk about, to a certain extent, are essentially doing what Google already does for human-readable searches, making it applicable to proteins. Right? These are just strings of letters, and while this is meaningless to you and me, and you can't really read it, a computer could look at that and say, methionine, which is the first residue, has chemical similarities to another type of residue, isoleucine or leucine. It's fairly hydrophobic. It's not charged, although it has that sulfur in there. And so you can think of there being some similarities to cysteine as well, although cysteine is slightly more reactive. So computers can look at that and they can grasp all of that in their metaphorical heads at the same time and be able to say, okay, well, this search query is similar, and maybe I can bring up this other type of protein which is similar. And so thinking about these proteins from the primary sequence point of view really reduces a lot of the questions that we have to thinking about how Google handles some of the same ideas. Some of the features are different because there is physical chemistry involved here, not just where can I find a good mechanic, but a lot of the computational treatment is similar. And so sort of the number one website that I think we're going to work on here, and has anybody used ProPero? Okay. This is a good one to start with, because this is sort of the number one website that I send all of my students to when we're starting to work on a new protein. It's the number one website I send my biologist collaborators to when we're starting to work on a new protein together. Because again, a biologist might think of a protein concentration totally different from the way a biophysicist would. And for a biophysicist, it really is important to know the molecular weight. It really is important to know what do you expect the extinction cone to be so you can measure an accurate concentration. And so this website is useful in that it tells you all that information. Nothing terribly profound about it, but you basically give it a sequence of one-letter amino acid codes, and it does a lot of calculations of basic chemical properties, things like the molecular weight. It can estimate what the isoelectric point is. It can tell you what it thinks the extinction coefficient should be. And there's other things in there too, and we'll take a quick look. How do you get at some of this experimentally? Again, we're not focused primarily on the experiments in this sort of workshop, but I'm sure, how many of you have run an SDS page job? Okay, so good number, even the computationalists.
Undergrad,
but
still.
Well, yeah, that counts. So here, you're basically running samples and using an electric field to separate proteins of different mass. And so the physical way that works is somewhat subtle. But each one of these bands corresponds to a different protein. And then you can compare it to standards here in the leftmost lane. And so this standard has a molecular weight of 30 kilodaltons. Or 30,000 grams per mole, then you know that this protein here has a molecular weight of about 30,000 grams per mole, or 30 kilodaltons. So that's one way. You can also use mass spec, and mass spec is really what we prefer when we're first starting to work on a new protein, because with a mass spec, you can get your molecular weight all the way down to one mass unit. So if you expect your protein to be 7,493 daltons or grams per mole, the mass spec can often get you 7,492 or 704,094. Kingsley's, which is right on.
But you can get much more accurate ideas of the mass using mass spectrometry. And it's another way to sort of understand, you know, is this protein that I expect to see really what I have in my test tube? Residue composition. Again, there are lots of ways to do residue composition. If you've taken your biochemistry, you've probably learned a little bit about Edmond degradation to determine residue composition. It's an important feature because, as Danger had mentioned, the number of cysteines will depend on whether you can, or will determine whether you can form disulfide bonds. And in some protein tertiary structures, if you have two cysteine residues and they form an SS disulfide, that's actually really important because that's critical to the structure. On the other hand, if those disulfides or if those cysteine residues are sticking out in the solution, so basically on the surface of the protein, and it happens to find another nearby protein just from floating around in solution, those cysteines can react and form an unnatural dimer. Right? And so knowing whether your protein has cysteines in it, obviously you can look at the sequence and say, well, do I see any Cs here? But if the sequence is 1,000 some odd residues, at the very least you're going to be putting it into Microsoft Word and hitting Control F to find the Cs. This will let you do it much more readily than that. I've listed some reducing agents and common concentrations that they're used at. That maybe you've used in the lab, but these are common additives to your protein preps and whatnot as a means of keeping those surface cysteines reduced. They each have strengths and disadvantages. We can talk about those later if you want. from an NMR, which we do some NMR, residue composition also comes up in that there's different regions of the HSQC spectrum where you expect to see different residues appear. And so glycines are often in this northern regions, tryptophan side chain, so indole protons are often in the southwest region, and then the rest of them are kind of spread out wherever. But understanding residue composition, when I used to be in a lab with my postdoc advisor, we were working on a new protein, one of his first questions was, well, how many glycines are in this? And that way he can look at the spectrum and say, oh yeah, no, we're seeing all of the glycine residues. We're seeing two glycines and you expect to have 15. In which case, that's a way to assess what your protein is doing. And so it's important to understand residue composition from specific examples in terms of number of cysteines, but overall as well. extinction coefficient is important in the sense that it's the primary means that we use to measure protein concentrations. And so tryptophan, again, which has this sort of aromatic side chain with an indole ring on it, has a nice and a fairly strong absorbance at 280 nanometers, right? So we can put it in a UV vis and measure the absorbance of our sample, and you'll see that there's a nice, for a peaks that or proteins that contain lots of tryptophan, there's a nice peak there at 280, and the intensity of that peak can be used to measure the concentration of the protein sample if you know what the extinction coefficient is. Now, if you don't know what the extinction coefficient is, well, then you can look at that peak and say it's pretty, but you won't be able to get any quantitative information out of it. So, understanding the extinction coefficient, we can estimate what the concentration of our protein is. And that's the common way that most biochemists will do that, provided they can. I've included some slides here on absorbance, just because it often comes up that I find my students need a refresher on measuring UV vis. We have Beer's law, which tells us that the absorbance at a particular wavelength is equal to the extinction coefficient times concentration times length of the path. And in this case, you're given some examples. Now, we're going to look here to see specifically how you can get extinction coefficient from ProPara. But let's assume that we've done some measurements. And in this case, we find that the absorbance at 280 nanometers is 0.348. The extinction coefficient, given that we're going to see how we calculate here in a second, is 9970 per molar per centimeter. And again, that only applies at 280, but that's what it calculates it for. The length of our cuvette, and so I use this guy as our cuvette. This is a 3 millimeter path length cuvette. Most cuvettes, if they're not standard, will have the length at the top. Most cuvettes, if you don't see anything, you can generally assume that it's a 1 centimeter path length. But this is a 3 centimeter path length, and so that's 0.3 cm, or 3 millimeter path length. And concentration's in there too. And so now it's just a matter of algebra. We can work out, so C is equal 0.348 over 9970 per molar. Centimeters cancel, and we divide by 0.3. And again, I don't have a calculator with me, but you guys could work out the concentration there and figure it out. So again, if we know what the extinction coefficient is, and we carry through all the units and we do it all correctly, we can determine what a protein concentration is in our solution, provided that protein is pure. If the protein is some mixture of many proteins, then clearly they're going to have multiple extinction coefficients going on, and it's going to become difficult to calculate what the absorbance is at 280. But by and large, if you're doing biochemical research over the summer, part of what you'll be doing is purifying your protein and getting it to a point where the protein is mostly pure, so that you can use this approach to calculate the concentration. Okay, so how does this work?
Well, here we can actually go up and the mouse ain't great on this, but let's do the best we can. So to go to ProTParam, the website is given here. I don't know the website off the top of my head. I usually just go to Google and search ProTParam. But it's part of what's called the XPASI, or Expert Protein Analysis System. So we'll see a couple of tools from this suite of web programs. I guess I gotta copy it because PowerPoint doesn't want to give me the ability to click it. Okay, open up our browser. And the program itself, I mean, it's not a lot of bells and whistles, but if you go to Google, it's particularly powerful, and there's not a lot of bells and whistles there either. The main thing that it's going to ask you, if you know an accession number of a protein that's already been well studied, you can put it in, but the main thing it's going to ask you is to paste your sequence. And importantly, this is asking you for the one-letter code of your amino acid sequence. And so in our slides, you know, if you're working along with me at a computer, you can just go to the previous slide and copy and paste the sequence for GB3 from that slide. If not, you can watch me do it and it'll give you the same result. But so I'm copying that sequence. I paste it in here. It's okay if there's spaces, so that's not a problem. But like I said, if you use the three-letter code, it's going to get confused. And so you've got it placed in the one-letter code, and all you do is you click Compute Parameters, and it gives you the result. And I'm going to try to make this a little bit bigger so you guys can read it. No, that's not right. Okay, So there's always, you know, a description of what the program is doing up here if you're interested in the documentation. But generally things are self-evident from all it presents. It counts the number of amino acids, so that's nice. So this is 56 amino acids. It calculates, again, it knows what each amino acid should weigh, particularly if it's making a peptide bond, and it also calculates the weight at the end for the carboxylic acid group and the amine. And it shows you what that molecular weight is, assuming natural abundance, right? So now if you're doing something funky, like labeling this with N15, that's not going to be the correct molecular weight. But it's easy to get to. We'll show you how. But assuming the natural abundance, this is what the molecular weight should be. And in general, if I'm doing mass spec, this number agrees quite favorably, usually within plus or minus 2. And I assume that those plus or minus 2s are probably like protons that are coming along for the ride. It calculates or estimates you for you a theoretical isoelectric point. Note that your mileage might vary on this. If you have a protein that's particularly high charged, this calculation is not going to take into account the fact that, you know, electrostatic repulsion or attraction will tend to shift pKa's around. This is basically assuming that, okay, if I have a histidine, it has an exact pKa of 6.6 or something like that. If I have a lysine, all of my lysines are going to be around, you know, 9.5, 10. If I have an arginine, all of them are going to be around 12. It basically picks a single number for every amino acid and gives you the pKa, assuming that that number doesn't change. So it's not necessarily the most accurate, but it does give you an estimate. And this is often helpful to thinking about solubility, right? If you have a protein that's neutral charge at pH 7, those proteins tend to be, now there's no hard and fast law here, but those proteins tend to be less soluble than something that's highly charged at pH 7. And so GV3 is one of those proteins where you can concentrate it up to like 4 millimolar. And so it's pretty soluble, and the low PI sort of reflects that. There's amino acid compositions. So again, if you're thinking about, you know, does this protein have a cysteine in it that I have to worry about? Well, there is none. So in that case, there's no cysteine. So I don't generally use reducing agent when I work with this protein in the lab. It's actually one of the reasons it's nice to work with. It does have, you know, aspartic acid, glutamic acid. There's glycines in it, so you can count the number of glycines. It's a lot of threonines, you know, it's probably the most number of threonines I've ever seen in a protein. And there is a tryptophan, so it should give me a reasonably good estimate of an extinction coefficient. If there's no tryptophan in the protein, for example, if you think about calmodulin, human calmodulin has no tryptophans. And so it's much harder to get the concentration of that protein because there's nothing that really gives you a strong absorbance at 280 nanometers. And so you might get stuck with the protein that doesn't have tryptophans, and we'll talk a little bit about that too. Then you can go down here, and this is where you get the atomic composition. So how many carbons, how many nitrogens, how many protons are in it. Total number of atoms, which might be useful for thinking about molecular simulation. This is where you would say, okay, well, if I'm making N15 labeled protein, how do I change my molecular weight? Well, you just add 1 for every nitrogen. So you would basically add 69 to the value that it gives you up at the top if you have an N15 labeled sample. And then it also calculates the extinction coefficients. If your protein did have a cysteine, it would give you 2 values here. 1 assumes that all of the cysteines are making disulfide bonds. And then the other one assumes that none of the cysteines are making disulfide bonds. And so those are useful extremes. You'll see that they differ by about 5-10%. But it turns out that disulfide bond itself has a measurable contribution to the absorbance spectrum at 280 nanometers. So that's why it's giving you values for that. Generally speaking, is in a biochemical setting, you're often trying to keep those disulfide bonds reduced by adding your reducing agents like BME DTT. So usually I just use the value that's there for all the disulfides are reduced. Those are called cysteines. If they're oxidized, those are called cysteines, and it's a slightly different number. And so we can talk about that in a second. And then it gives you some estimate. Again, this is I've never really used this personally, but it's giving you an estimate for how long that protein would be around if it were expressed in different types of cell culture. And so in this case, you know, if it were in mammalian cells, it would give you an estimate of about 30 hours. This is not thinking about like anything having to do with folding or thermodynamic stability. It's strictly the stability of the protein in a particular cellular environment before other proteases start chewing it up and getting rid of it. And then it also gives you some information about hydrophobicity and whatnot. I'll show you here quickly what happens if you add a cysteine. So we'll add 1C to the end of this and recompute. The nice thing about this is it's instantaneous. So you can see the molecular weights change. Now we're at 57 amino acids. But importantly, if I go down here to the extinction coefficient, you can see it gives me two values. Now again, there's only one cysteine here, so I guess I should have put in two. But assuming that they're if it's forming a disulfide within the chain, it's going to give you a different number. So let's go back. Let's put two in and see what it does. Hopefully it doesn't make a liar out of me. Yeah, so you can see it's two values. Again, if you have reducing agent and if you know something about the structure of your protein, you can usually assume one or the other of these. And in most cases, I'm usually assuming that they're reduced. The difference is not incredible. You know, it's a factor of 100. I would argue that's probably less than the precision of UV-Vis in the first place. But if you have, you know, 10 or 15 of these things, it can add up. And so then you might have to use a little bit more of a creative approach to getting your protein concentration. Often biochemists are specifically trying to avoid proteins with large number of cysteines, or they're trying the immunogenesis to get rid of them. So usually it's not a huge factor. And so now if we go back here into our presentation, so we've talked about, you know, molecular weight, composition, extinction coefficient, how you can use that extinction coefficient in the lab. But, you know, as I alluded to, there are going to be proteins that don't have tryptophan. And for those, you know, let's go back and let's take a look, see what happens when we get rid of the tryptophan. Okay, so I delete the tryptophan, hit compute. Okay, so it gives you a little warning. It says this protein does not contain any trip residues. Experience shows this could result in more than 10% error in the computed extinction coefficient. So it's using what it can. So there's a little bit of absorbance from tyrosines that it's using to calculate this. And it's giving you the best estimate that it can. But it's also telling you that, hey, this number might be off. And so generally speaking, in these types of situations, if you go into a lab where they're doing this, they will probably tell you what extinction coefficient you should be using. And so, you know, again, as with everything really in this session, if you're working in a research setting and your advisor says, do this, and it's in direct contradiction to what I say, you should do what your advisor says. Because presumably they're going to be the ones that know the most about your system. You know, it doesn't hurt to mention it. Well, what about this? And they can probably give you a good reason why that doesn't work. You know, these are some general ideas that work for a lot of proteins, but they don't work universally. Okay, so what if your protein doesn't have tryptophan? Well, obviously that means that there's going to be low or even no absorbance at 280 nanometers. And so there's a couple of different strategies. I mean, you can go back and do things by mass. And you can measure concentration if you have a dry protein sample. That sometimes works. One of my friends, Nick Anthus, I got to work with him when I was a postdoc, came up with an approach he wasn't certainly unique. He made it into a nice computational tool where you can use the absorbance of the backbone itself. And so the peptide bond has an absorbance around 205 nanometers. And you can use that absorbance as a means of estimating your protein concentration. And so Nick has written a nice little tool. It works very similar to ProParam, but in addition to giving you an estimate for the extinction coefficient at 280 nanometers, it gives you an estimate for the extinction coefficient at 205. And so if we go to this website, scientist and scholar, I love it. We'll go and grab our sequence here. Even remember the undo. So here it's giving you some of the same information. It's giving you, in this case, he does some calculations for natural abundance versus different type of isotopic labeling schemes. We were both in an NMR lab, so that's relevant for us. But here, he gives you the extinction coefficient at the very bottom for 205, so the backbone, assuming that there's no tryptophans. And if I go and change this, and here if I delete that tryptophan again, my absorptivity or my extinction coefficient at 280 goes way down, but my extinction coefficient at 205 is relatively unchanged. It changes because I lose amino acid, basically. So you can use this value as a way to estimate your concentrations even when you don't have tryptophans. This one is slightly less precise. And so again, if a normal absorbance measurement is that off by 5 to 10%, I would probably put this one closer to 10%. We've done some measurements with calmodulin where we've compared by mass to what's measured. We've also done some other types of dry peptide measurements, and we find it to be pretty reliable. It's there as a caveat. You probably want to do some confirmation if your experiments really, really depend carefully on the concentration of the protein. There are some complications here. If you go back and look at the extinction coefficient, the value is quite high. If the value for GB3 with tryptophan is about 10,000, this value is almost 190,000, right? And so there are some complications. You can't measure absorbance at an infinitely high number. It turns out that absorbance is really only good for, roughly about 0.1 to roughly about 1. You can exceed those boundaries a little bit, but if you're trying to measure an absorbance and the spectrometer is telling you your absorbance is 4, that means that only one in every 10,000 photons are getting through. And so that's not a very precise number that you would be measuring. And so you really want to be working in that 0.1 to 1 range. And if your extinction coefficient is 190,000, that means that the concentration of protein that you're going to be working with to get a readable range of absorption is going to be pretty low. And you can do some calculations similar to what I'd have to be, or what concentration you'd have to be at to get an absorbance in the range of 0.1 to 1. So that's one complication using this. Another complication is the fact that if you're using buffers like heaps or pipes, a lot of the goods buffers, TRIS is another big one that lots of people use, they all like to absorb down in that range too. And even if you take a buffer blank, if your TRIS buffer is already absorbing 99.999% of all of the photons down at 205 nanometers,
that, and you subtract that out, again, you're taking a very big difference, and you're trying to measure, you know, one or two photons at a time. And so just subtracting out a buffer might not be enough. And I generally recommend for students that are doing this to work in water or do a big dilution, since you have to dilute anyway generally, to dilute into water, and that way you lose some of those complicating factors of your buffer absorbance. And so that would be my suggestion if you have to go this route. Again, if you want practical advice, I can give that to you, but this is sort of just showing you where to think about or where to get this information if you find yourself up against this. With your extinction coefficient, again, this doesn't give you exact, I mean, you know, you're never going to get an exact extinction coefficient for something the size of a protein. It's usually pretty good, but, you know, in some proteins that the extinction coefficient can be bad. And if you have bad lab technique, you know, your concentrations are going to be bad anyway. So it's always good to remember that, you know, you're probably dealing with a 5 to 10% error whenever you calculate your protein concentration. Oftentimes that's okay because, you know, more protein concentration, if there's a 5% error, it's usually systematic. So if I'm trying to make comparisons when I have a small amount of protein versus a large amount of protein, that should still be fairly accurate. But your extinction coefficient itself, the absolute concentration, might not be the most accurate number there is. As I mentioned, you need to be working with absorbance constant or absorbance values in the 0.1 to 1 range. You know, the lowest I would probably trust is 0.05. The highest I would probably trust is something like 1.2. But if you get too much farther out of that, that means there's not enough absorbance to make a difference, or there's so much absorbance that you're really only measuring the scant photon here and there. And then if you have aggregates, so again, lots of proteins aren't particularly soluble, those aggregates are going to scatter light, and that can also contribute to your absorbance. And so a very easy way to check for that is to look at your UV-Vis, and if it's zero at 600 nanometers, it's a typical place where light would scatter, that means you probably don't have a lot of scattering. If it's not zero, then you do have scattering, and you got to take that into account. Now, zero could be like, you know, 0.002. I mean, it's, you know, all these things have relative errors. And then if your protein solution isn't pure, well, then that's going to contribute to the absorbance too. So all these things go in that you just can't take the number out of the website and use that and then expect it to give you the right answer if you're not thinking about the rest of it. And that's true for a lot of the things that we're going to discuss over these next couple of days. Websites are great in that they give you numbers, but you've got to have your sort of lab thinking cap on, where you're thinking, okay, what could be contributing if this number isn't giving me the value that I'm expecting? Or what are the limitations of this website so that I can make the best interpretation of my data possible? And so that's always good to realize. And you know, even here in the very first website we look at, we see that we could be in a position where we're not getting the right values out of what we have. Okay, so time for you to start talking again, because I've been talking a lot. The extinction coefficient can be calculated from primary structure alone. That is, you know, it doesn't really matter if it's a beta strand molecule or if it's an alpha helical molecule. If you know what the number of tryptophans are, you have a pretty good estimate on what the extinction coefficient is. So talk amongst yourself and say, well, why is that important? And you know, if that were not the case, what would be the problems if that were not true?
So if you didn't have access to a database or something, you'd be an average of the place.
Okay, what'd you guys come up with?
So we came up with that because you can get it from the primary structure alone, you don't need to know secondary, tertiary, quaternary. You don't need to know any other structural information. All you need is the sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's reasonably important because if you've got your protein in non-standard conditions, then you can have alterations in your structure or even your protonation states of different amino acids. So just knowing the primary structure, it doesn't matter what conditions you placed your protein in, you can still figure out its concentration.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's a big advantage. You know, for the very reasons that you said, if you know, for example, if your protein isn't soluble or terribly soluble enough to be able to use this equation, you know, if you try to concentrate it past, you know, a couple micromolar, and now your protein starts falling out of solution and aggregating, well, it means that you can, you know, you can put your protein into something like urea, which makes it very, very soluble, and measure an extinction coefficient in urea, or the absorbance in urea, and now you can measure the concentration at a number that you can actually read. Now there'll be slight differences, but again, probably not within the 10%, 5% error that we were talking about. The other thing, though, that can go on is, you know, just because you measure the concentration of your protein and you get a real value, and you run a gel and you even say, hey, it looks relatively pure, you know, there are cases where after you purify it, it doesn't have the right structure. And so you can't assume just by looking at the absorbance spectrum that your protein has the right structure or the native functional structure. So that comes back to bite people sometimes too. But you know, the fact that you can just use a computer like this, and it makes it much, much easier to proceed, because oftentimes when you're starting with the protein from scratch, you might not know what the tertiary structure is. Maybe that's the whole point of what your experiment is to, you know, purify it and get some structural information out. You know, you don't need that information to generate the very basic quantity of the concentration. Okay, so the second thing that we're going to talk, or the second big website that we're going to talk about today, and a lot of these can be used with proteins, so we're presenting them in the context of protein work. But you know, if you have an RNA or a DNA sequence that you're interested in, you know, these can all be used too. Maybe not so much the protparam, but we'll see that there are similar websites for DNA tomorrow. But the next site that we use a lot, again, most of them were scouting. So again, when I'm presenting this, I usually think from an undergraduate student or a very young graduate student, or maybe not young, but an early graduate student who's basically been given a project and their advisor says, you know, go learn about this. And then sort of the experiments or the line of research develops throughout that project. And so often if you're in that situation, you're going to be like, okay, well, how do I find out some information about this protein that I've been tasked to study? Or if it's already something that's fairly mature in the lab that you're working in, you know, how do you get caught up? How do you see what the current research and topics are? And so the National Center for Bioinformatics is a federally funded agency run out of the National Institutes of Health, I can't remember what NCBI fully stands for. We'll probably see it when we click on the link here. But they maintain a library that encompasses not only all of the published journal articles, and at the very end of the session, we'll talk a little bit about EndNote and how you can manage journal citations, but they also maintain all sorts of public repositories about, you know, this is what this gene's function is. These are the important mutations that cause genetic disorders in people. These are the, you know, this is where this particular gene is found in the human genome, as far as chromosome number and you know, locus. And so that information, at least much of it, can be found in this sort of collection of
NCBI databases. And there's a lot more here than we have time to talk about. So we're going to cover sort of the basics. We're going to cover what you can look for and maybe what to avoid. But there's a whole bunch of things like, you know, express sequence tags. So what genes are actually expressed in different cell lines at different times. There's a database for that. there's an expression, or there's a, you know, information on clinical behaviors of different proteins. And so if person A has this particular variant and person B has this particular variant, does one or another of those variants predispose them for some kind of genetic illness or genetically based illness? We're not going to talk about all of this stuff on here, but hopefully what we'll see is that you know, using some very simple search approaches, you can get a lot of information about the protein of interest. And so let's figure this out, because I always forget what this acronym is. National Center for Biotechnology Information. So there you go. The website, again, is very very subdued as far as its design. They emphasize function over form, but it basically has everything that you need. And this is a list of basically all of the databases that NCBI maintains. Again, some of these are quite pedantic, and so like the books database. You know, if you click on books, it is exactly what you think it would be. It's a list of generally biochemistry, cell biology, molecular biology, organismal biology, textbooks that, you know, the publishers have made available on the internet. You can't download the whole textbooks and print it here, but if you're searching for a section on Bruce Albert's Molecular Biology of the Cell, you're not going to find the latest edition, but they'll have previous editions that you can go search and find information, excerpts from that text. You know, can be very useful to supplement a biochemistry or a genetics textbook if you want to look at something that you might not be familiar with, or you want a little bit more reading about. The nice thing here is, you know, unlike when you search Wikipedia or just go into Google, this information is reliable, or should be reliable as any textbook that you would look up. And so in that sense, you can search through this and have a little bit more confidence that the information being returned has been peer-reviewed, is accepted in the literature, or by the field of experts. But there's other things in here too that we're going to take a more specific look on. This has often been called in the past ENTREZ, so ERNTREZ. My first exposure to ENTREZ was actually when I was in high school, and I was at a summer nerd camp. And we first started looking at how to search ENTREZ. It's undergone several iterations since then to now where it's just called, you know, NCBI databases. I think they figured ENTREZ was a little bit too confusing and was like, what are you talking about? Whereas databases is crystal clear. So these databases have a lot of information on them. And so your input could be anything from, I mean, you can give it a sequence, but generally you're giving it things like your gene name. If you're searching for a particular organism or a pathway in a particular organism, you might search for that. You can look at authors if you're looking for journal articles or particular sequences that an author has tried to publish. You can even search by things like, you know, give me all protein sequences between 1,500 and 1,600 amino acids from this particular organism. And so it's a collected database of genetic information, protein structure, primary structure information, literature information, and then some additional sort of curated pages where, you know, they might have a page on phenylketonuria, or they might have a page on Huntington's disease. So you will look to, and at that page, it'll have sort of offshoots into all of the genes that have been identified for that particular type of ailment. And so you'll get, you know, accepted DNA protein sequences. You know, given that there's, you know, so many billion people in the world, you know, what is the accepted sequence for calmodulin? You know, there's obviously going to be lots and lots of genetic variation, but when a researcher tells you calmodulin, they're usually talking about a specific amino acid sequence. Same thing goes for hemoglobin or Huntington, the protein. So how do you know what those are? You know, oftentimes you can find it or trace it back into you know, a database like NCBI. You know, viral and bacterial strains are even worse, right? Because if there's billions of people, there's many, many more billions of viruses and bacteria. And for something like HIV, how do you know what sequences have been accepted? What are the acceptable sequences versus what are the different variations out there? You know, this database can help you sort of tease that information out. And so if we go in here, and I don't usually have a particularly, you know, rigid, I guess this is all. I usually don't have a particular, you know, way that I work through this database, but let's search something that will be pretty obvious. So let's search for phenylketonuria. It's a metabolic disease where, you know, individuals can't properly metabolize phenylalanine. It's one of the big diseases that they test for at birth now in first world countries. And so normally if you have it, you know it within a few hours. Yeah. Maybe I need to go to Google to figure out how to spell it. Ah, yeah, there's no U, or there's no E. Okay. So there we go. This should bring up something. Okay, so and it's treatable. I mean, it used to be, you know, bad, but now if you look at your foods, they all have, you know, notice to phenylketonurics. This contains phenylalanine. Okay, so when you search for something like that, it has all of the databases, and you'll notice that now numbers appear by each of the databases, and that represents the number of hits, or the number of places in that database where this search engine has found something pertaining to phenylketonuria. You know, the ones that are potentially interesting to us are things like protein, which will contain protein sequences that are associated with the disease. OMIM, which stands for must have clicked when I hit protein. Online Mendelian inheritance in man. There's also things for the different genome. And so you can think about, you know, the Unigene database or just the regular gene database of, you know, known genetic transcripts associated with this disease. And you can look through the rest of them. There are clearly some structures that have been associated with this. You can look at all of this information, and the nice thing is it's sort of cross-linked. And so if you click into OMIM, the Mendelian Inheritance site, it's going to give you a sort of summary of that disease, but then it's going to have cross-references into the protein database. It's going to have cross-references into the gene database, so you can look to see what genes and loci are associated with the particular disorder that you're looking at. And so let's click there first, because I think that'll be a nice introduction. And so, you know, the first thing that it shows you is, okay, well, it gives you the page for phenylketonuria. Now you can see that there's all sorts of other diseases that have been associated with phenylketonuria, lots of them apparently on the autism spectrum disorders. But the very first link here in OMIM, which again you can see up here is a specific database that is being searched now. And if I down click that, or if I expand that, you can see that there's a lot, you can search through all the databases individually if you really want. But the very first link is this particular disorder. Always asking for money. And now, okay, so now it's basically a description, right? So somebody at the federal government in NIH sat down and said, okay, well, somebody interested, and this could be anything from a researcher to somebody with a patient that has this disease, to a physician who's treating a patient that has this disease. And, you know, you can go in and you can say, you can basically look at their written description and says, okay, well, you know, it's a deficiency in phenylalanine hydroxylase. This is an enzyme. It says what the enzyme does. If I'm interested in phenylalanine hydroxylase, I can go click on this link. And so now you can see that, okay, there's a description of what the protein does. There's some references to papers that maybe summarize what the protein does, and its different functions. You can see things like, you know, the gene structure, you know, how many base pairs does it encompass? Are there exons? Are there introns? Where is the location? So you can go and click information on all this, and now you can find links from PubMed, which is another database that stores a lot of the scientific literature, right? So that information is here. You can continue to scroll down. It has information about this function. Again, all this is curated and somebody wrote a description of what this gene is particularly doing. Towards the end, you'll see more of the actual representations of, you know, how do you get information about what the sequence is. And we'll talk about how to search through that too. There's all sorts of modifications to this. So again, it's one gene, but there's lots of ways to make a single enzyme inactive or partially active. So you often have to talk about different mutations that can lead to different manifestations of the same disorder. And so there's all sorts of additions to this record. And if you keep scrolling down, references down here. And then here at the very bottom, it has information on who did this. You can see the last time they did this update was 2013. So again, for particularly novel or late-breaking illnesses, you might not find all that here. And now over on the side, you can see, okay, well, where is this gene appear? Where is phenylalanine hydroxylase appearing in the human genome? And so here, it's giving you a map. I thought it would give me a map of phenylalanine hydroxylase. No, it just searched for H. Okay. That might be a bug. Okay, so phenylalanine hydroxylase, here it is mapped on the human genome as far as chromosomes. If you search down here, you find the PAH gene. You can click on that map element. It's a little slow. And so now you can scroll down and look at all of the other surrounding genes on that chromosome. So there's information here about the chromosomal location of the gene. And you can continue scrolling in, and I think eventually this will take me to an actual sequence. Yep. And so here is the GenBank DNA sequence corresponding to phenylalanine hydroxylase. Okay, and so now, you know, again, if I'm interested in the actual genetic information, you know, there's some other stuff here too, as far as, you know, taxons, you know, more bioinformatics information, references. You can view this as just the sequence by clicking on FASTA. That's one way if you're trying to get sequence information. You could then maybe take this tomorrow into some of the protein or the DNA tools that we'll talk about to translate this sequence. But really, you don't have to do that because GenBank has all this information here. And so you can see how starting with online Mendelian inheritance in man, you can sort of dig down and find specific and very useful information about that particular gene. But we can also, I mean, we don't have to start there. And suppose your advisor goes to you. I'm just going to search Entree. Takes you to PubMed. Okay, well, let's go back and click the link. So suppose your advisor says, okay, we're interested in phenylalanine hydroxylase. So again, let's see if I can spell this. Phenylalanine. Yep, okay. So if I click that, again, some of the same links will come up. You'll see something in online Mendelian inheritance in man. But if you're interested in the protein structure, you can go and you see that the protein database has 1,746 hits. And that's a lot of hits. I mean, if you think, well, there's only one type of person in the world. And so when you look at those, you see that there's a lot of different hits of varying quality, right? And so one of the things that's going to be important here is sort of assessing, you know, looking at a list of results, which ones are the ones that I'm actually interested in. And so, you know, if you look through some of these, yes, this is called phenylalanine hydroxylase. Yes, it is from human, so that's something we didn't think about specifying. But here it says partial, right? And it only gives you 3 amino acids. And so I'm not really exactly sure why this would be, why you would say 3 amino acids has to come from phenylalanine hydroxylase. Maybe they did some kind of triptych or digest of it. But you can see the only amino acids are G, L, and Q. That's not particularly useful to us if we want to maybe go into ProParam and say, well, what's the sequence and molecular weight of phenylalanine hydroxylase? So we go through and we keep on looking down. And so there's some more partial solutions from Homo sapiens. There's this one from Bombyx mori, which, you know, again, I'm not sure what organism that is, but it's not human. And if you keep scrolling down, eventually you see that there's a big mess and that maybe we want to be able to tighten up our search a little bit. Right? So we don't want to search all of the partial stuff. We want to find sort of curated sequences that are known to be good and precise for what we want. And so that's where these next set of slides can sort of come in and maybe help us to refine the search results that we're getting. And so the first two that I think are the most important when you're searching for proteins are SourceDB RefSeq, which means that you're only going to search sequences that have been denoted as reference sequences. So generally, these are sequences that the community has come together and agreed, you know, they stand some particular importance in the field. And oftentimes, those are like what we were talking about. If there's, you know, 50,000 sequences of calmodulin, the reference sequence is usually the sequence that's the accepted sequence of calmodulin, and all variants are expressed or talked about relative to calmodulin. And so let's go back and let's see what happens if we change our search query to include reference sequence. Okay, so I'm still here searching in the protein database. And I'm just going to add and. So in NCBI, if you're adding modifiers to the search, they always have to be in capital letters, like and or not. And then we add sourceDB, refseq, and then prop. And so prop is a modifier too. It says that's a property of the sequence. So the sequence should have the property where it's coming from the source database of reference sequences. And now if I hit enter, I'm going to get much fewer numbers. And in particular, all of these appear to have reasonable numbers of amino acids here, right? 400, 500, much better. But you see they're still coming from all over the place as far as organisms, right? So what I really need is a way to say, okay, but I only want to look at humans. Right? Or if I only want to look at mice, I want a way to do that. And so the way to do that, and again, if you're looking at your slides, is to say human and then give it the property is human being the organism. So if I add and human and then specify the field type organism, O-R-G-N, now it's only bringing up human Homo sapiens phenylalanine hydroxylase. And in particular, some of these you can immediately start weeding out because this one is predicted. So if you're looking for something that is the accepted protein sequence of phenylalanine hydroxylase, this first hit is going to be your best bet. Notice that as a reference sequence, its accession number, or if you think of its sort of overall database number, generally starts with an NP. So the N, for some reason means reference sequence, and then P means for proteins. There's similar values for genes, like I think RNA is NM. But if your sequence starts with an NP, that generally means you're working with a fairly well characterized culled sequence that somebody has actually looked over before. Recall that investigators can post, they can upload any sequence they like into GenBank, and it may or may not, presumably they're uploading something that's meaningful, but it doesn't mean that everybody has looked over every sequence and accepts that that's what it is. They could be uploading phenylalanine hydroxylase from some, extremely rare African tribe that, might represent, 0.0002% of the population. That's probably not the sequence that you want to be using if you're thinking about, characterizing it in biochemically. So there's as a reference sequence entry, there's lots of journal articles up here. So that's what all this information is. You can scroll down, and now there's all sorts of stuff about regions of the protein. So if there's particular domains, those will often show up here as regions. Things like phosphorylation or post-translational modification often show up in here as far as features. And so here is, that's a site that's just regulatory residues. So regions that interact with other proteins will often be notated here. And then at the bottom, again, this is our sequence. And so now you can't get all the information about this sequence on NCBI, but I can copy and paste this and now paste it into ProTParam and get general properties about this protein using the sequence that's given to me here. If I don't want information on, if I don't want all this other information, I can click FASTA, and that's basically an abbreviation, and now it's just giving me the amino acid sequence. And so this is going to be a little bit easier to cut and paste into ProTParam. Okay, so there are strategies that make it easier to find different types of proteins. And a lot of these will work throughout the NCBI database system. Reference sequences and PDB sequences really are most relevant for DNA, proteins, RNA. But if you're searching within a series of journal articles, you know, you can restrict your journal article using this colon notation. And so you can find dates of the sequence between 1998 and 2003. That's a great one to use. You know, my advisor used to say to me all the time, "Oh yeah, I think Robert Lauren published a paper back in 1994 in JMB on this." And you know, he's an advisor, right? So he might be off by a couple of years. So this is a great way to sort of search for, oh, okay, let's look for the papers by this guy between this particular set of dates. You can restrict it using author names. You can use abbreviations if you're saying, oh yeah, that was a Jacks paper. You have to know what the NCBI reference or the abbreviation for that journal name is. But oftentimes you can find that just by, you know, searching a few and looking to see, like, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences is Proc Nat Natal Acad Sci USA. So once you know some of those, then you can really start you know, digging down and refining your search. As we've already talked about, you can say you can use and ors to combine search queries. So if you want to say, you know, this author and between the years of, you know, 2000 and 2015, you can do that using these terms here. You can also search for things like chemical properties. And now these are kind of cumbersome to be typing over and over again, but you can refine based on sequence length. You can refine based on molecular weight if you're interested in a protein, using these types of modifiers here as well. There's ways to do advanced searches, and so we haven't looked at that yet. But if I click on this advanced button, again, I'm often in a situation where I don't necessarily know what the modifier is to select for an organism, for example. But you can go in here and you can say, okay, well, organism. And now you can search for organisms specifically. So the advanced search is something that you can play around with if you're like, oh, I'm getting too many hits here. Is there a better way I can maybe try to refine the search values I'm getting out of this? Okay. I think in the interest of time, we're going to leave the practice. But this is something, again, we have the evenings off. I don't know. Maybe you guys are going to go out and experience Starkville nightlife. But, you know, here are some things that you could go home and practice maybe at the end of the day. You know, if you have a project that you're working on, what's the protein? Try using it in some of these databases and see what you can come up with. Okay, the protein data bank is another database, again, not maintained by NCBI, not maintained by the European Bioinformatics Initiative, but it's maintained by another organization where basically now what you're storing there is the three-dimensional coordinates of lots of different protein structures. Okay, we're going to talk a lot about this you know, during the PIMOL session, so we're going to sort of abbreviate our discussion of it here, but nevertheless, I can go on to Protein Data Bank website, and here again in the search query, I can go in, I can search for phenylalanine hydroxylase. I can refine that search by clicking here on the left-hand side. And my search queries that come up are here on the in the center of the page. And so you can see, you know, the protein data bank contains all of the structural information that's been solved. Right? So if somebody does, you know, six or seven different mutants or variants of phenylalanine hydroxylase, they might have six or seven different structures here in the PDB. But, you know, you can go and you can sort of look to see through the titles, you know, what is the best way to, what is the best representation or if they have mutants, they'll often say what the mutation is. You can also refine. So if I want to refine to PAH, and then refine to Homo sapiens. Okay, so now you can see that there's individual domains that have been solved. So not all proteins have been solved in their entirety. You can see that there's some kinds of mutants here. So A313T is an alanine to threonine mutant. When you click on that structure, you know, notice that each one has a four-character identifier that goes with it. You can click on that structure. You can get a picture of the structure. You know, tomorrow we'll talk about downloading the files and what the files look like and how to visualize them in PyMOL. You get information about the quality of the structure, so its rank order on various different metrics relative to other structures. So there's a lot of information here that we, again, we'll cover more in depth tomorrow, but you can sort of see that there are, you know, you can sort of use this as a means of filtering out different types of structural data here as well. And so generally the first thing I do is I put the protein properties in. The second thing I do is I check on the PDB to see if somebody solved the structure. Because both of those are enormously informative if I'm starting up a new protein for the first time. And so again, this is sort of, you know, for the ricin protein, which was actually solved by one of our faculty here when she was a postdoc, it has a four-character PDB code. The PDB files that we look at tomorrow basically just contain the coordinates. I mean, they contain a lot of other stuff too, but they contain the three-dimensional positions of all the atoms in the structure. And again, you can think about the radius of atoms and their size. I want to de-emphasize this a little bit because tomorrow we have a whole session devoted to PyMOL, where we'll look at protein databank files. And then the last website that we'll, again, just briefly look at, because, you know, you could spend, you know, probably a whole week just browsing there, but is the KEG database, so the Encyclopedia of Genes and Genomes. And so this is extremely useful if you're thinking about the protein's function in the sense of the larger context of metabolism. And so here, when I search for phenylalanine, again, it gives me some options. Usually the options here are a little bit less in depth, but now if I look at a record, I can get information about what mechanism or what pathways that particular enzyme is participating in. And so phenylalanine metabolism is obviously one of the more important ones. And if I click on that, now you can see all the information. Okay, and so here's our highlighted protein. But you can see, okay, this is one of many, many enzymes that takes phenylalanine and helps it, you know, in this case, to become tyrosine. And so if you're interested in the particular types of mechanism that enzyme is doing, well, then this is the website. And so, you know, this can help you sort of understand, well, what other substrates might be competing for this particular reaction in the cell. There are ways to bring up the actual chemical reaction. And so if you click on the enzyme itself, I think... So you can look up the substrates, you can click on the reaction, and so there's the reaction that's catalyzed by that enzyme. You know, the thing I want you to take away from this is that there's a whole boatload of information that just by knowing what websites to start out with and by doing some reading, you can find out a whole lot of stuff about a particular protein that you might be interested in. And so this is great not only for when you're doing research, but if you're maybe in a biochemistry class, you're saying, hey, go find a protein of interest and tell me a little bit about it. You know, this is how you can go in and learn about the different types of things that your enzyme might be, you know, catalyzing in the cell. Obviously, we started out something very big, you know, the ProParam, where anybody can upload any sequence that they want. To, you know, we've worked our way down in the terms of amount of effort that goes into each entry, right? So NCBI, again, you're still in a situation where lots of people can upload lots of sequences that may or may not be important to you. PDB, you know, now you're in a position where some investigator has spent weeks or months, you know, determining what the structure of that particular protein is. And so there's a lot more information, but it's much less or much more focused. You can't go to the PDB and expect to find every single protein in the PDB because they haven't solved the structure of every single protein. And then finally, with the KEG database, you have specific entries corresponding to specific enzymes where the pathway or the mechanism from going to point A to point B is known. And so we've sort of dialed down here into the most narrow, so there's the least amount of information as far as breadth in the KEG database, but the most amount of information as far as depth, as far as understanding what it does and how it does it in this database as well. Okay, and so these four, I'd say, are probably the most important four that you can go to get information on how this enzyme is working, what it's doing, and what can you expect it to do if you maybe start playing with it in the lab. And so we'll skip our think and discuss for the interests of time. What I'd like to do now, before we break for lunch, is... you know, I would like to get this program funded through NSF. And so to me, that means showing that I've been doing it. And one of the big aspects of showing that I've been doing it is getting a picture of you guys and sort of the group every year that we have a record of, you know, the participants. And so what we'd like to do is, if the weather permits, go out to the front steps of Hand Lab, grab a picture, then we can break for lunch. If you're interested in seeing the NMR facility downstairs, you know, we'll do that too. And then what I'll do is I'll lock this room over lunch so you don't have to worry about somebody. If you want to leave your laptop in, it should be locked out. Now, on the other hand, if you come back half an hour early, I might not be here. But I will lock the room over lunch if you want to leave your stuff here. And then we'll meet back. Yua is going to take over the third session. And I'll be sort of in the audience because there'll be more personal interaction. You guys said you wanted to go get your laptops, and I think it'd be great to have a laptop if you do have one for that third session. Okay, questions on what we've covered? I know this is, you know, this is going to be a pretty intense couple of days. I'm not going to lie. Okay, let's go get the picture. I think if we're lucky, my grad students should be out there meeting us, along with the secretary that's going to get the picture.